RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
With over 250 publications to his name, Michael Foreman is one of Britain's most awarded, successful and loved book illustrators. And not only as an illustrator, he has penned 70 of his own stories. He has also collaborated on 25 books with the former Children's Laureate Michael Mapurgo, among many other authors. He was born during the Second World War. His father died just a few weeks before his birth, leaving his mother to not only bring up three boys, but to also run the village shop single-handed. As a working-class boy living in rural Suffolk in the 1950s, it was preordained that he would be destined to work in the local fishing industry at nearby Lowestoft. But while delivering newspapers, he was befriended by a newcomer to the village, Tom Hudson, a young art teacher who recognised Foreman's natural ability to draw. Hudson helped nurture that talent and direct him on his creative journey, which took him to Lowestoft School of Art and then to Central St Martin's School of Art, and finally on to the Royal College of Art, where he gained a first, along with a travel bursary prize to the United States. His first illustrated book, The General, celebrated its 50th anniversary in 2010 and is still in print. His autobiographical record of a wartime childhood, War Boy, is on the school curriculum. I recorded this interview at Michael Foreman's home in Putney, where I first asked him to recall that early wartime childhood. You were born in 1938, and I believe your father died just a month before that.
That's correct.
And so you were three brothers.
Yes,
you,
I was.
And your mother ran the local newsagents, and that was in Peakfield.
It was Southern. The village shop. I mean, she did the newspapers, but she also sold vegetables, sweets, cigarettes, second-hand clothes, firewood, whatever the villagers needed.
So how big was this village? Was it a...
It's a small village, but it's right on the edge of Lowestoft, and it's where the buses from Lowestoft would turn around. It's like the bus terminus would be around our shop. Our shop was on a little island in the middle of a big kind of four roads came together, one of which was the main road from London, and our shop was number 2 London Road, and the pub opposite was number 1 London Road. So I always thought that, you know, I was in a really important street. Be the village street, it was the road to London.
A lot of this has been lovingly recorded in your book, War Boy, which I read the other day. And in 2006, it was reissued as paperback because it was originally published in, I think, 89, is that right?
88, 89, but it's been reprinted. It's constantly been in print.
Yes, yes.
And I think quite a long time ago it went into paperback as well as the hardback.
I noticed there were two different, on the original, it was A Country Childhood, and then later they changed that to A Wartime Childhood.
I hadn't even noticed that.
Maybe it was because it became an animated film as well.
Yes, and also it became part of the school curriculum for history. So it's a bit spooky that, you know, your childhood is already history. And so that's why they pushed the wartime thing rather than the country thing.
Yeah, it seemed, you know, reading it, looking at the illustrations and seeing all the things you got up to, even though it was, you know, a very dramatic time, being wartime, the early part of your life anyway, it still seemed very idyllic and free compared with children today.
For children, it was a time of enormous freedom because virtually every family in the village was a single-parent family because all the dads were away in the war.
Yeah.
So we could run wild. You know, the mums were all working, of course, in factories and whatever. So out of school, we were just, you know, really running wild. But being in the village, of course, everybody knew who every child was, so you were never really able to get away with anything because they all thought, particularly me, because I came from the shop, and that's the boy from the shop. So anything that happened could often be traced back to the boy at the shop and his mates.
And you, now, from what I understand, you didn't have many books in your house, but you loved magazines. Magazines were your kind of thing, and things like John Bull, because they had illustrated covers.
Yes. Now, we were fortunate because the magazines and comics came into the shop on a Wednesday, but they weren't delivered until Sunday. They went out with the Sunday papers, so I could read every magazine and comic between Wednesday and Sunday.
So do you think, was that your entree into illustration, being aware of illustration and different styles and so forth, if you were consuming lots of...
If it was wet or in the evening when it was dark, drawing was all I did.
Yeah. And again, from what sort of age? When did you?
Oh, when I was 4 or 5. And the biscuits in the shop would come in big tins. They wouldn't come in individual little half-pound packets like they do now. They'd come in a big tin. And my mother would have to weigh out half a pound of biscuits for Mrs. Briggs down the street or whatever. But the tins were lined inside with white paper. One side was corrugated and the other side was flat. So taking this paper out, it'd be 4 feet long. And I could spread perfect. That on the kitchen floor, and I would just draw from one end to the other. And there would be parades of soldiers and whatever, or circus animals or traffic.
I suppose, you know, living in the local newspaper shop, it was inevitable that you became a paper boy.
Yes.
And it was during being a paper boy that you, one of your customers was a teacher at the Lowestoft Arts, and he invited, and I think you sort of befriended him or chatted to him, but he suggested that you go to a Saturday morning art class for kids.
Yes, he'd just arrived in the village. When I was delivering his paper, he asked me if there was clay in the local cliffs. And I said there was clay in the cliffs. And when we were younger, we used to make models of tanks and Spitfires and things from the clay and bake them in Mum's oven and paint them camouflage colours. And he wondered if the local clay was good enough for his students to do pottery from. And so I took a bucket of clay. And it was rubbish, of course. It's too gritty. But he then said that he was starting the Saturday class. And I went along to the first one, absolutely loved it. And what I loved about it was he took us out into the village and onto the cliffs to draw real things. We sat down in front of stuff and drew. We didn't sit in the room and do stuff from the imagination, which we did at school, of course. Actually, the lessons at school, for a couple of years, they were very good because the art class would follow a religious broadcast. There'd be like a Bible story at 1:30 on the BBC. We'd all listen to it, and then we'd have to illustrate what we remembered from this. And it was terrific because you had to draw pyramids and horses and chariots and angels. And
that's interesting.
That was good, but it's all from like imagination.
Sure, so already you were kind of sequencing, maybe without realizing.
Illustrating
images,
a story.
Yeah. Well, he obviously noted your talent because he encouraged you and helped you get into art school because he felt you showed a lot of promise and you went off to...
Well, he talked to my headmaster. I was pretty hopeless at school and he got me off going to school 2 afternoons a week. He got me off doing woodwork and religious studies, I think, the two things, and music. And I could go and join the big art students in the art school on those afternoons. So at the age of 15, I could leave ordinary school and go full-time, which I then did, and did the usual intermediate and the NDD thing, and then got into St Martin's for a year.
That would have been in the late 50s or sort of that time.
Yeah, 50s.
Just winding back a bit, you say that you were hopeless at school. So academically, it was not your...
No, I was quite good at English. I like writing stories.
Yeah.
But maths and things, once it got to algebra, I was completely lost. And also the expectations were nobody took exams in our school. I mean, I failed 11 plus.
Why was that?
Because it was a secondary modern school.
Yeah.
And you went into the trades, which
of course,
why we were doing woodwork and metalwork.
Of course, yeah.
And most people went into either fishing or shipbuilding.
Or presumably on the land as well.
They would tend to be from a farming family if they did that. But most families were fisher folk.
So you end up at St Martin's. So that must have been quite a dramatic shift, because you would be obviously in London.
Clearly
wouldn't have commuted because it's a hell of a long way.
We used to come up from my primary school. The first time I came to London was a day trip to the zoo. We came down on an old coach, went to the zoo, and we parked somewhere near in Camden Town and walked up Parkway.
Yeah.
And I remember, because I grew up in a shop, looking in the window of this tobacconist shop, and I saw lots of little cards in there for flats to let. So when I came up to go to St Martin's, I went to the very same shop to look at these little cards. And one had a flat to rent in Charlecote Square in Chalk Farm. So I was walking along Chalk Farm Road looking for Charlecote Square, and this young black guy came up to me and he said, "Oh, do you know where Charlecote Square is?" I said, "Oh, I'm going there. I'm looking for a flat." He said, "So am I." And we were looking for the self-same flat.
Oh, really?
But when we got there, Charlecote Square and I were very, very smart. And the landlord's a Pakistani. And he said, in fact, he had two rooms up in the attic with a cooker on the landing. So the Nigerian guy, and we took the two rooms. And he became a friend then. I mean, he was best man at both my weddings, for instance. And so it went off with this chance meeting. Because I went back to this news agent shop to look for an address. And each time I moved, he moved with me, you see. So we moved all around London, as you do when you first arrive.
So you were at St Martin's for just a year?
Actually, it was 2 years.
2 years.
Because I was trying to avoid going in the army, to avoid conscription.
Yeah.
And so when I finished, I did NDD painting at Lowestoft. When I finished that, I was then due for call-up. But I thought, I persuaded the local authority that having been trained as a painter, I was going to be, you know, a burden on society. But if I did a commercial art course at St Martin's, I would be much more useful. So I got, deferred from the army for 2 more years.
Yeah.
And during the course of that, they ended it. And while I was at St Martin's, I applied to the Royal College.
Now, was it at St Martin's that you were looking around for potential freelance projects?
I started that at Lowestoft. I needed to make some money to contribute to the house. I was fortunate because I was the youngest of three brothers. My two older brothers were working, bringing money into the house. So the family...
What did they do, your older brothers?
One was a mechanic.
That was Ivan and Bernard.
Yeah. Ivan was a mechanic, and Bernard started as a mechanic but ended up working in the shipyard.
So they were both very very physical, more traditional.
Oh, absolutely.
So you were the first sort of artistically...
Well, I was the first
leaning person in your family, really?
They never got the chance to show whether they were or not.
Yeah.
And had I not had older brothers earning money, I wouldn't have been able to take that chance either.
So in your last...
Oh, sorry. So while I was at Lowestoft, I went to the local paper to see if they needed like some cartoons done. And they said, OK, give it a go. So I would do probably one or two drawings a week for them. And then I started getting approached by one or two of the advertisers in the paper to draw for their ads. So I was making £5 or £6 a week, which was really good.
So you were doing, 17, 18, this sort of time?
16, 17. So when I came to London, living up in Chalk Farm, I went to the Hampstead and Highgate paper to see if they want any drawings. And I do the occasional one for them. But one of the shops I was doing drawings for in Lowestoft was the local music shop. So I went to the music shop in Hampstead to see if they would like that. I just could see they were taking ads every week in the Hampstead and Highgate thing. Would you like them to draw? Oh, yeah, okay. So then I was drawing for... And then I thought, this is daft. I'm in London, drawing for the Hampstead and Highgate. Further down the hill, you get Fleet Street with all the...
magazines.
The Nationals.
And the newspapers.
So I went there. I went to the Sunday Pictorial, as it then was, and then it became the Sunday Mirror. And I would do lots of... I think during the first Wilson government, I drew virtually every... Well, certainly all the cabinet and most of the opposition.
Really?
Caricatures, which they could use whenever they had a story running that featured any of these people.
So when did you sit down? Because from what I read, you were exploring the possibility of more freelance work, and you actually created that first book, The General.
Yes.
Was that before the Royal College?
No, that was... Yes. No, it was published in my first year at the Royal College, end of my first year at the Royal College. So I actually did the work during the summer between St Martin's and the Royal College. I enjoyed the buzz of working for newspapers, but of course your work lives for a day, and then it's binned.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if you do a book, it might last longer. And so my wife and I at that time did this story. We were both members of CND, and we did the marches and so on and so forth. So it's obvious that if you want to do a story about anything, it should be about peace, peace and war. And that was the...
And that's been recently reissued.
Yes, to mark the 50th anniversary.
That's right. Yes.
So it did last longer than the daily paper.
Yes. So you end up at the Royal College of Art, which to study graphics rather than pursue illustration. Why
they didn't teach illustration at the Royal College then. No, I don't think they had... I don't recall there being any illustration course anywhere in Britain at the end of the 50s.
Well, that I didn't know. So you had to, there were some terrific illustrators through there.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Absolutely.
But obviously they just studied graphics.
David Jethman.
He studied graphics.
But they had two kinds of graphics. They had graphic design and they had decorative graphics. And I think the decorative graphics was very much along the kind of Edward Borden thing. I think it's for people too scruffy to do graphic design. And there were two camps. I mean, the graphic designers would come in their suits, like they were, you know, working in Madison Avenue already. And the decorative graphic people would be...
Who were your contemporaries at that time there in the college? Would it have been Len Dayton, or was that after?
No, it was after. My contemporaries would be were David Hockney, Zandra Rhodes, Ozzie Clark.
So that 60s...
It's very much the 60s thing,
set. So very much, you know, fine art... that the little group
well,
there?
Well, I found, because it was in the old Royal College building, which is part of the V&A complex, and the canteen that we all used would be the V&A canteen restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were stairs leading from the back of the Royal College part of the building down into the V&A. On those stairs, I found a large landing, and I set up my easel. I was doing large abstract paintings on the landing between the Royal College and the V&A.
Oh, really?
And occasionally, a painting tutor would, on their way to get a cup of coffee, would stop and have a chat about it. I remember Joe Tilson and Sandra Blow and people like this, whatever. So although I was doing decorative graphics, I was very much still doing painting.
Okay.
And completely abstract paintings.
Yes.
As opposed to the, you know, obviously very illustrative, figurative illustrations.
And you also worked on ARC magazine a bit, didn't you? Or you did illustrations for
well,
ARC magazine.
Well, I did a few bits for ARC, and then we did... Then I was appointed art editor.
Yeah.
And it's the only issue of ARC magazine to ever be banned and pulped.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you do?
It was very political, basically.
Okay.
I mean, the files...
So did you ever keep a copy? Presumably you...
I've got a dummy.
Right.
Which I loaned to the Royal College about 10 years ago. In the typesetting department at the Royal College then, it was called lead type and everything,
yeah,
which I loved doing.
Yeah.
There's a chap there called Harry Greenaway.
Right.
And he has a copy, he claims. One that wasn't... It was like an early copy before it was firmly run off. He has a copy.
A proof of it.
A proof copy, yeah. Copy. Anyway, my dummy was mysteriously missing while I'm on exhibition at the Royal College. So all I've got is my paste-up of the thing. I mean, there were various... We did sort of daft collages, really. I mean, I had a picture of Princess Margaret in a Union Jack bikini, which they thought was... Yeah. But it all went through. Everything was... It was all gone. You know, everybody on the committee approved everything fine. Until Robin Darwin, who was the principal, saw it.
Yes.
And then, oof.
That was it?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you picked up a first-class honours degree
yeah.
at the Royal College, and also you got a silver medal and a travel bursary.
Yes.
Which took you over to the States.
Yeah.
And where, I gather, you were art director of Playboy, is that
well, that
correct?
Was a, that was, yeah, that was... A, not, well, there were four art directors, but that was two or three years later. The first... time I went there, I just used the money travelling around
right.
on the Greyhound bus. I made a few contacts in New York and Chicago. And I would then go back. The next summer I went back really determined to... And I found an agent. And I was then working for magazines in New York. And I met a chap, an English guy, who at a party, who the next day was going to Playboy as an editor. And he said, come with me, just bring your portfolio, you'll pick up, you know, some freelance work. And when I got there, they had a position for an art director. And I had 4 weeks left on my permit, on my travel thing. Said, have a month's trial. So I did a month's trial and absolutely loved it, of course.
I should think.
But a month later, I was bored, because it's the same old, same old.
So what were you actually doing?
I was commissioning illustration. At that point, Playboy had used very, very good stories.
Hmm.
Very, very, I mean, I can't remember the names of the writers now, but they were really top-notch
yeah.
American authors. And, you know, I'd ring up Milton Glaser or Tom Unger. And I remember, he's probably sitting on the beach taking this call, and he's going to be doing this. I want to be the other end of the phone. I don't want to be in the office. So I gave a month's notice.
And you presumably then came back to the UK.
Came back to the UK, and there were two magazines over here which were kind of trying to rip off Playboy. There was Penthouse.
And King.
And King.
And that's the magazine.
And
you...
I went to King. And when I got, just before I went to America, just behind, well, a year back behind me at the Royal College, were a couple of students I started doing work with as a little group. One was a photographer, the other was a designer. And we formed this little group called Three Inc. And
who was the photographer in there?
The photographer was Roy Giles.
Yeah.
And the designer was Dave Chaston.
Okay.
I think now is living in San Francisco. So when I came back from Playboy, we got hired as a group, as a team, to do King. So I would do virtually all the drawings at one point, with different names.
Where was it based then? Was it near Fleet Street?
It was just off Fleet Street.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we'd use, you know, Fleet Street cartoonists, and it was a really fun job.
And how long did you do that for?
2 years, maybe.
Right. So that would have been, what, 60...
65 to 66, because I remember doing a special. We did a special issue on the 1966 World Cup
right.
thing.
And then you gave that up and became permanently freelance.
Yeah, each year I'd do one or two books.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I had enough books out bringing in little royalties for me to concentrate pretty much on that. But I also was teaching part-time at the Royal College.
And you were also occasionally collaborating, or at least working with people like Derek Birdsall. I mean, you do illustrations for, I think, the IBM magazine that he used to...
No, Mobile.
Mobile magazine,
Pegasus.
Yes, that's
magazine.
Right.
Yeah. No, he was instrumental, really, in giving me a fantastic chance to work on really great subjects. And
I mean,
also
you did the Updike covers for Penguin.
Yes, yeah. But the main thing from Derek would be the travel that we were able to do, because we did books in Japan and Africa and of local crafts. And
yes.
It was just fantastic.
I've seen a number of those books, and the illustrations are really...
And
beautiful.
We did, he also got Japan Airlines. We did their magazine for a while, and that was terrific, just flying here, there, and everywhere.
So you went off with him and would draw on the spot?
Draw on the spot. Often I would go with Harry Pecinotti.
Yes.
He would photograph.
Who was the other collaborator with Derek, of course, on many of his covers. And he was, the first Nova art director.
Yes, and he gave me lots of wonderful commissions at Nova.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's a rather nice little group of people that knew that.
It was, it was unbelievable, because the clients that Derek attracted were
very good,
special.
Yeah. So you built up your early books, which started to bring in royalties and income, and you were also doing these rather more, glamorous jobs, going dotting around the world. Because
the Playboy one was interesting, because when I first got there, of course, I had nowhere to stay. I mean, Hefner had this mansion. At that point in his life, he was very much a hermit, and the staff never knew when he'd get up, and he hardly ever left the mansion, and he'd kind of live in his dressing gown or whatever. So the kitchen was on 24-hour alert, and it was huge, vast thing, and the top floor was where all the bunnies from the Chicago Club lived. It was called the Bunny Dorm. So they'd be sitting around in the big Italianate grand hall, with their hair in curlers and face packs and so forth. And the kitchen would be there churning out stuff. And so I lived there for...
You lived in
initially, when I first was there, until I found a little apartment. And so that was, very surreal. But it was a bit like being home living in the sweet shop, because when I was a tiny boy, of course, sweets were rationed, except for me, because I was in the sweet shop.
And they actually, sweets didn't come off ration until the very end.
And they went back on ration after a while, because all the rich people were buying up all the sweets.
So there you were with all these sweets in the sweet shop.
Yes.
My goodness. Did you sample many? Well, I won't go. We won't.
I never had much of a sweet tooth.
We've established you were back here and established yourself as a full-time book illustrator.
Yeah.
And I've tried to work out how many books by looking at your own... Wikipedia page and other pages, and I can't work out whether you are responsible for 237 books, according to Debrett's, or 180 books plus 57 by yourself. I don't know whether add those two together you get 237, but maybe you could tell me how many books have
I don't
you
know.
Done. It's a
well,
lot.
It's more than
it's
that.
It's a hell of a... More than 237.
Yeah. I'm very old.
No, but you must be very prolific, because what is your routine? How does it work for you? What's your daily routine? Has it changed that much?
It hasn't changed much. It's changed only when the boys stopped needing to have the school run. I would do the school run in the mornings. My wife picked them up in the afternoon. So I'd be back home by about 9:15, and then the day would start, and I work until Louis shouts supper, and that's 7 days a week.
And when did you first start to have the courage or feel confident enough to write your own stories as well?
Well, from the very beginning, because nobody would give me a story. They didn't know who I was. Mm. So if I was going to do a book, I'd have to write my own text. So the first books I did were my own text, with the exception of The General, which I did with Janet. So after that, the first... half dozen or more would be my own text.
And you said earlier in your life you enjoyed writing anyway. That was something that came to you relatively easily.
And also the things I wanted that I thought were important weren't being written about in children's books. They thought, children aren't interested in the environment or whatever. Mm. I mean, I did dinosaurs and all that rubbish over 40 years ago. It's still in print. Mm. And it's about the environment. And children know about everything because they watch TV.
And they know more about everything now than ever before, because it's obviously the internet. Do you find time to relax, or are you working all the time? Because I know that you've got a house in St. Ives, and we can talk about that in a minute. But would you say you're a workaholic, or
probably because I'm relaxed when I'm working.
Yes. So you're doing something you like.
I had to go to some function a couple of afternoons ago. There was some book start. It's a charity that gives books to children who need them, so forth. And it was on the roof garden at Kensington, and the Duchess of Thingamabob was going to be there, and it was all lovely and sunny and so forth. I was really, really frustrated because, you know, she was late, the whole thing was late. I thought, you know, I could be home working this. And so that's when I get worked up, is when I'm prevented from getting on with stuff.
And you're mostly working, I mean, I know you have a wife and children, but you mostly have always worked alone, apart from these earlier little groupings. And do you enjoy that?
Yes.
You don't like the camaraderie of others?
I do. I mean, when these things happen, I do. But I don't, when I'm actually working, I'm used to, I find it's kind of, if I'm bored working on my own, then the stuff I'm doing is going to bore other people. Mm. You know, I need to be entertained. I need to be, the characters I'm creating or drawing, a company.
Of the books that you, of these many books that you've written, what are the ones that you feel mostly express you, that you're happiest with? If you can be happy with, you know, it's very difficult.
Well, but, you're right. There's a problem about doing books, is that you may have 30 or 40 pictures in a book. And when you finally get that book back, you think, the pictures you remember, all the ones that don't work. Mm. Wish I could have done that again. And da, da, da. So every book's full of disappointments.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I agree with you because, you know, it's a little bit different now, but certainly in the more analogue days clearly you still work it in that way. Maybe we can talk about technology a bit in a minute. But often in those days of paste up and sort of scamps and all that, when you see the final print thing, I always got that impression too. It was always a bit of a disappointment. And I thought about it long, and I think it's just the familiarity. It's no longer a big surprise, you know. Whereas these days, with modern technology, you can almost get that highly finished standard instantly and get an instant hit. Mm. It's sort of different. You don't have that long gestation. You can virtually do something, create something in the morning and see it beautifully printed in the afternoon yourself.
Yes.
You know, if you've got a great digital printer, bang, there it is, sometimes better quality than the printing.
Yes. that is interesting.
Tell me a little bit about your connection with Cornwall, because it goes back quite a long way.
Yes. Well, the very first time I heard about Cornwall was from a sailor who was a friend of my mum's during the war. Quite how friendly he was, I don't know. Our shop and the little room at the back of it was always full of soldiers and sailors. And for many, it would be their last bit of England before they went. They would come to our village to train before they were sent overseas. And so my mother became attached to many of them. I mean, they were not much older than my brothers, many of these chaps. And anyway, one was a sailor who told me, he used to take me fishing with him, and he told me stories about Cornwall and pirates and smugglers and giants and stuff. And it just seemed like a fairy tale place. So when I was at St. Martin's, one of the teachers there, Joe Tilson, had a cottage in Cornwall, and he said I could use it. So I was just got married at that point, and I bought an old car, and we drove down to Cornwall, and this cottage was on the moor above Zenner. And we walked down to Zenner to the pub on the first day, and the next day went to St. Ives. And I just thought, now I know why Ben Nicholson and Terry Frost and all my heroes, why they are here. And I thought, when I'm an old man, I want to be here. And it's that very first day. And then, you know, fortunate things worked out, and I now live in Ben Nicholson's old house.
Yes.
With his studio in the garden. And
built a rather nice little tower on the top.
Yeah, well, it was a copy of the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that's my little spot.
And you can see it from, if you go onto the little harbour,
you
can look back and see it sticking up. I've seen that. I mean, so that's a long time. You've been there for...
Well, since that was 1960, the first time I went there. And I bought my first place in 1970, and I've moved down there twice since then. But we've been in the Nicholson house for 30 years.
And your studio's up the top, isn't it?
In the garden, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. which overlooks the whole bay.
Yes. So isn't that rather distracting?
Well, that is distracting.
Because it is so beautiful.
The thing about Cornwall is that it's the setting for many, many of my books,
yes.
Even if the story isn't about Cornwall,
yeah.
Because it's never-changing landscape. There's kind of tremendous dramatic rocks and...
It can change in an instant, can't it? It can be suddenly engulfed in mist. I mean, I live by the sea in Dorset, and I'm very aware it can be sunny in Dorchester and misty in where I live.
The sea is very... I remember, being a little boy, we couldn't go on the beach.
Because of
the mines and the barbed wire.
Yeah.
But there was the sea, and the stuff would, towards the end of the war, when the convoys could come through, get bringing in produce to our shop, grapes and dates and things, and the dates would come in little boxes with pyramids and palm trees on. And I want to go and see the places. So for me, the sea joined up places. It didn't separate them. You know, it connected places. And I always think that a particular... Well, standing on the pier in St. Ives, you just look to the left, and there's nothing but horizon.
Yes.
So the whole world is there.
And you know that it just goes right across the Atlantic as well. It's quite a long stretch.
Yeah.
And a different colour water, of course.
Yeah. That's the other thing. Oh, the soup.
The blue.
Travelling on the old steam trains, there'd be these little watercolours in the carriages.
Yeah.
Of different views, and I thought there'd just be this Cornwall bomb, this blue-green scent. No, it's not like that, it can't be. And of course it is.
And of course that sort of vibrancy of colour crops up a lot in your work.
I mean,
you use a lot of very vibrant turquoises and blues, which you really use the watercolour effect to great effect, I think.
Yeah, people often comment on the blues, and is that because of Cornwall? But I think it's because of...
Well, you're wearing blue, I must say, which is not evocative.
It's a Cornwall fisherman's sweater.
Fisherman's smock.
But that comes from my love of Impressionism, really.
Right.
Because I suddenly realised that if they're painting shadows, they don't put black in it, they put blue in it.
Yeah.
It's a cool version of the sunny colour.
Yeah, yeah.
And so blue goes into my shadows rather than...
Now, your method of working presumably hasn't changed at all.
No.
So you don't engage in any modern technology apart from maybe the convenience of sending something off to let someone see.
Yeah, my son does that for me in the evening when he comes home from work.
So you don't get anywhere near?
No. The only technology I use, well, it's not technology, I mean, it's kind of Stone Age technology, is a copier that enlarges things. So I can do a little sketch and I can then enlarge it a bit more, but that's just no different from the old...
The Grant projector.
Exactly
so. Cool, which is like a great big pram.
Yeah.
I remember that well.
But that's the extent of
it. So that's, well, you know, it's so really...
Although now it's interesting because a couple of books here, which they've been out of print for many years, they want to reproduce them.
Yeah.
And I've sold most of the originals. And
The original drawings?
Drawings. And so I've been trying to find the best printed edition from which they can then reproduce.
Yeah.
But the thing about modern technology now is that you can see how well they can reproduce it, and then you can adjust it slightly.
Absolutely,
you can kind of heighten the contrast or so that's...
And have you started to produce your own prints at all? Because that, you know, now you...
Not seriously.
Because I know, for example, Peter Blake, who has embraced, you know, modern technology, obviously I wouldn't have thought it was he personally that presses the buttons, but you know, he has so many prints out now, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Using all sorts of modern, you know, not just traditional printmaking, but giclée printing, which is a really high quality print.
Well, that one up there, those cats, is kind of giclée, that one, yeah.
So that's a print. I mean, the quality of those things.
I just can't get my head around distribution. It would take me away from drawing new things. Get involved in distributing other things, which is why I don't have a website, because I don't want to get inundated with requests for this and that.
Yeah. So I had noticed that you hadn't got a website. So you don't embrace readers' sort of engagement with you.
Well, I think it will involve you in going to the post office every day, sending stuff off, you know, packets of this and that.
Oh, I see.
You know.
So do you get fan letters from kids? I mean, obviously,
you get different kinds of letters. You get the ones from a whole class where they've been set this project. So, but then you get individual ones. But even within the class project ones, you get some really interesting individual things.
Mm.
But I do a lot of interaction with children through Chelsea Football Club.
Right, okay.
Since they bring schools into the club, rather than me going to schools, they bring the schools in there.
Right.
And the advantage of that is that they have studied two or three specific books, so they come armed with good questions.
Yes.
It's not like random. You turn up at a school, they don't know who the hell you are half the time and or what you've done. But I find that's a good thing of finding out what works, really.
And with War Boy, which, as you said earlier, is sort of on the curriculum, sort of, for kids.
History.
Because kids, they all do the Second World War. Yeah. I mean, my children did, and, you know, dress up with little tickets on, and they go down to the Fort Knowth in Weymouth, where the guns were and so forth, and spend a day living, you know, experiencing what an Anderson shelter was and school. That must please you no end, because, I mean, that book is probably something that they'll all read.
Yeah, of all the things I've done, that's because it's about my mum, my brothers, my schoolmates, you know, these soldiers and sailors who came through the village, and it's all about people I
and were you very
like to remember.
Were you very involved with the animated film?
The film actually was War Game, it wasn't War
Game. Oh, yes, it's War Game, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
First World War.
Yes. Yeah. You didn't get involved with War Game at all, they just took an option on the book and
yes. Yeah. I did some extra drawings.
Did they faithfully reproduce
the feel? Yeah, it was pretty. I think I was pleased with the way it looked.
So I'm surprised that they didn't engage you as the sort of art director or as it was your work, as well as the way films are. Do you get a chance much, or do you look at a lot of illustration yourself and what's going on today?
Yes.
What's your view of illustration now in this 21st century?
I think there are some very good illustrators coming through almost. But they would have come through anyway because they don't seem to. They seem to be the odd one, the oddballs.
Mm.
You know, the ones who still think it's important to be able to draw really, really well.
Mm.
But there's a terrible fashion in illustration for the scribbler. It's a rash, where particularly in children's books, where they think if it's for a child, it should look like a child friendly, almost like a child has done it. So, and these are the people who are being rewarded with the illustration prizes and so forth because the people and the judges don't know anything about it. There are no really, or very few, serious reviewers or critics of illustration anymore. And so there's a kind of downward spiral. It's rather pressing. But, you know, despite this, there are some really good, serious illustrators. And if they're really fortunate, they find a good publisher who appreciates it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, is that I think when I was starting out, I was lucky because there were publishers who were real publishers. They'd be like Willie Collins at Collins. There'd be Andre Deutsch, Victor Glaser. You know, it was a company run by somebody who absolutely loved books, and he would publish books he wasn't that happy about in order to support the books he loved. And now they don't do books they love. They just do the books that are going to make the money.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm
very aware of that. I mean, that I worked in publishing for 10 years, and I worked in publishing before that American invasion, where they started to buy all of those little quirky individual publishing houses, and which there are very few, very few now. And I think you're right. I mean, it is about they even refer to books as units. They don't.
Well, this is the other
thing. It's books anymore.
Yeah, and the really sad thing again is that when I was starting, there were many independent bookshops.
Yes.
Now there are very few.
Well, that's, again, modern technology. I mean, Amazon, the fact of the matter is, your books, for example, you buy them in an independent bookshop, full price. You go onto Amazon, and they're half price. It's as simple as that. And I mean,
I haven't really got a great beef with Amazon. It's the big bookshops, the big chains that are ruining the.
I think the big chains are all slowly dying. I think they will. I think that they'll all go unless they've got. I mean, in America now, they've introduced in some states this instant print-on-demand bookshop where you go and have a coffee. You select. So, for example, you know, one of your book, you go in and say, "What book do you want? Okay, I'd like The General." And they'd say, well, do you want the original? Do you want it in the original version or the paper? And you say, well, I have the original version. go and have a coffee, and they tap in the computer, and there's a fantastic printer and binder, and by the time you finish your coffee, in a bag is your book. Mm. Now, that's, you know, it's going to get better and better. I mean, it's not, still not perfect, but we know how quickly technology is advancing. And so I think, you know, book, the whole, it's like the world of music, which has changed dramatically. Yeah. You know, bands now get their money by going on tour. They don't get money necessarily from the sale of CDs anymore, because basically there's so many illegal downloads. So I think this whole book thing is on the verge of something. But the main thing is the work gets out there, I think, is...
Well, it is. I mean, when the book printed on demand, what sort of breakdown financially is that for the person who originated the book?
Well, that I'm not sure. I presume that there would be, just as with online books, there's got to be some contract and there'll be a royalty agreement. Because at the moment there's quite a hoo-ha about download books being virtually the same price as physical books. And they're trying to change that, because clearly you're not getting a physical object, you're getting the book into your computer. So you can't. It takes up no space at all and costs very little to actually. So it's it should be something like that. The highest ratio should go to the author, would seem to me, because what do the publishers have to do apart from just send an invoice or a PayPal thing? Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's going to be quite a dramatic few years, because it is changing all the time. And although, having said that, looking at Penguin, for example, they every week seem to be bringing out a new series of original, you know, original stuff, kind of regurgitated in old covers or covers that look old, but they're not really. They've been given that sort of...
Yeah.
So people are still enjoying books. But we know that last year, Amazon, for the first time, they sold more digital books than physical. That's how it's going. To someone like you that makes books and loves books and surrounded by books, probably of some concern.
Yes, it is.
We're talking about illustrators just now, your view of them. What advice would you give a young up-and-coming illustrator who has admired your work or, you know, your career and wanted to get, you know, wanted some pearls of wisdom from you? What would you say?
I mean, this really, you know, going back to what we've just been talking about, there seems to be less and less or fewer opportunities now to be an illustrator anyway, wouldn't you say?
There are a lot of illustrators. I mean, shocked at the number of illustrators.
Well, this is the thing, but the illustration courses are getting bigger and bigger. You know, I know people who teach, and it seems to be that art schools are an industry for themselves. I mean, they get in as many people, particularly from overseas, who pay the top whack, through the doors without there being nearly as many opportunities these days as there used to be.
And I suppose, you know, your college life and Royal College as well, that was at a time when fees were paid for.
Yes.
Now it's... You know, we all know that kids that go to college have to take out a big overdraft, and there are more and more going out. I totally agree. I think, you know, it's the same with graphic design. Every single old polytechnic turned into university or whatever, they all bolt on a graphics course, mostly very poor, not particularly good tutors, and they bring in the foreign students who are paying top whack, as you say, and shoving them out in the marketplace with no jobs.
Yeah.
And likewise, you know, there are, because of, again, digital technology, there are lots of illustrators using that form, the digital form, or blending it with traditional, you know, illustration, literally doing the skeletal work and then colouring in. I mean, you probably saw the Hockney exhibition recently, and did you see his iPad?
Yes.
Work? Now, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
A guy, you know, who's always embraced,
yes,
you know, modern technology, Polaroids, whatever, actually has mastered... I mean, I actually personally bought that little app for my iPad. It's really difficult to use, really difficult. So, you know, and I can draw a bit, but, I mean, I don't know if you've tried that at
all. I haven't. I was tempted, because I was really impressed by the work he had done, especially particularly that size.
Yeah.
There's a chap... Tim Viner. Do you know Tim Viner? I've used his work. Another thing that I've been doing for 50 years is this little literary magazine called Ambit.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know.
And so that's when I really come across new illustrators. And like the first person I used, nobody gets paid to contribute to this thing.
Yeah.
So I have to rely on friends, and at that point when I first started, fellow students, including David Hockney. But Tim Viner is now doing work for The Times, I think, about the Olympics. And he's been following around the torch relay thing around the country. sending back daily things on from his iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting because...
And those are drawings?
Drawings, yeah.
Right, okay, I'm not aware of that. Yeah. I'll have a look.
He did the World Cup in Japan.
Yeah. But,
so he's very much into that.
I mean, as Hockney said, it's just new tool. He said, you know, modern technology at one point was a pencil.
Yeah.
So it's no different. So I was just interested to know whether it's something you might dip into, because I think you might find it very interesting.
Yes. I've been asked this last week to do drawings of Southwark Cathedral and the shard and all that thing, you know.
Mm.
And so I went along with this little sketchbook and a camera, and I thought, you know, if I had money, I could have done it there and then.
Going back to what we were saying, advice for any young up-and-coming...
Well, I'm a terrible dinosaur when it comes to this. I just think you should go to life classes and do all the stuff that I had to do, perspective, history of architecture. I think if you can draw really well, I mean, draw anything, really, or you should be able to draw anything. My big problem was horses, and because I found it was very difficult, I had to really concentrate, and I got pretty good at doing it. So now I like... So I think drawing is the basis for all of it.
Mm.
I just fear that it's getting less and less important, though, because fewer and fewer people expect it or recognise it, and maybe with technology you can get around it also.
What are you currently working on? What are you doing now? What's your latest project?
Well, I usually have four or five books at the same time at various stages. On my table upstairs at the moment is a book written by Michael Morpurgo.
Oh, who you've collaborated with quite a lot.
This is the 27th book, I think.
Yes, wow. How do you work with him? That would be interesting to know. Did they simply send you...
No, it's very, very odd. We met 30 years ago.
Because he's from Devon. Yeah.
And we met socially. Well, we met at a school. We then went out a couple of times, and he gave me a story, and I didn't want to illustrate it because it was set in Venice. I'd just done a book in Venice, and I said, no, but why don't we do a book about... And I suggested King Arthur, because he's living in Devon. I was in Cornwall. And obviously that's the part of the country where these Arthurian things are supposed to... So we did a book about King Arthur, working together. So then we did Robin Hood. And then so it went on from that. And so it's often a collaborative thing. Sometimes it's his idea, sometimes it's my idea. The one at the moment is a story I've been trying to do myself for about 10 or 12 years.
Right.
And couldn't get the voice right, couldn't do it. So I told him the story. So he's done it. And of course he's changed it dramatically from the way I would have done the story.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of subject. It's about the First World War, the first black officer in the British Army.
Right.
He was also a very good footballer. And then he's then brought it through into the Second World War and then up to date, which is what he's very good at.
Yes.
Suddenly engaging a child of today in something that's historic. I'm doing another book about the First World War, which I'm not going to give to anybody else, which I've been trying to do for 25 years, based on one of the bus drivers used to come into my mother's shop was a sailor in the First World War. And on the beaches of Gallipoli, he was sent ashore to bring back some wounded. He was under fire, dived into this little crater, and a tortoise rolled in beside him. And being a country boy, of course, he stuffed the tortoise up his jumper. I said, you know, coming over me, boy, look after you. So he took this tortoise through his wartime experiences, hiding him in the gun turret of HMS Implacable, till he got back to the village, and the tortoise outlived him. So as a boy, I went to meet this tortoise. So it's a story about Henry as a young boy, then going in the Navy, rescuing the tortoise, and then the story of the tortoise. So, and the thing about that is his son, Don, was a contemporary of mine at Lowestoft Art School, and he, like his father, was a tremendous collector of everything. So Henry collected all sorts of wonderful things, which Don has collected also. And so at the back of the book was going to be a big kind of archive of all these things from the First War. And the tortoise became a local celebrity. It was in the local paper every spring and autumn. You know, spring has sprung. Ali Pasha, the name of the tortoise, is awake. And he was on Blue Peter.
Right.
He was the only non-dog member of the Canine Club of Australia.
Bizarre. I never heard of this.
No, it's just a little village story.
Yeah.
But I wanted to stay true to the real man and the real tortoise. But if I'd given it to Michael,
it would have become something huge. So when do you hope to...
Well, it's with a publisher now doing the dummy.
Okay.
And they want it to be well-produced.
So you've written it already?
Yeah.
Oh, you have? So it will happen.
So I've started doing the pictures, but I can't finalise the pictures until the layout's all done.
Sure.
It's quite a complicated...
Do you get involved with the design of the layout and the typography, the covers?
It depends on how good the publisher cash is.
Yeah. Because, I mean, having trained as a graphic designer yourself, I would have thought that's something that would really be...
Yeah, really spare sometimes.
Yeah.
Particularly when it goes into paperback, because, yeah. you get the first edition, you like to kind of keep your hands up. But what happens to it when it goes into paperback, and then it goes into the cheap paperback, and then it goes into black and white? And suddenly they say, no, children only like novels if they've got photographic covers. So even if the inside of the book is illustrated by your drawings,
you have to have
put a soppy photograph of a dog on the front. Waterstones. You know,
So that's two books. And you've got another...
The third one is with the same... is Templar, a very good publishers, very good high production, doing the Tortoise book. But they also want the book of my travels and sketchbooks and things going back over 50 years. And that's going to be quite a fancy production, I think, with flaps and different kinds of papers and sketchbook pages. And
so would this be more of a kind of retrospective?
Yes, retrospective of the travel drawings.
So a lot of that work you may have done with Derek Bezzel, travelling, that sort
much,
of work, that would be
and
very interesting.
Written with, the notes in my diaries and things would be. So that's an exciting one. And then I do the usual, the 32-page, I usually do two of these a year. Different things.
Wow.
Super Frog's my
one
of my heroes. And then there'll be this one, for instance, is just about to come out. Friends, this is our cat. You see our cat all around the place. He died he died just before we moved here, but he's a Cornish cat, and it's about him and my mother-in-law's goldfish. So it's the friendship between the two.
That's sweet. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, and I really look forward to seeing them all. Michael Foreman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.